Hello, and welcome to the Chest Journal Podcast, where each month we host a discussion with the authors of important articles from the current issue of the journal, adding context and commentary to the challenges facing clinicians in the fields of pulmonary, critical care, and sleep medicine. To introduce today's topic, here's your host, Dr. Dominique Pepper.
On behalf of CHEST, I'd like to welcome you to this month's CHEST podcast. My name is Dominique Pepper, and I'm the host of the CHEST podcast section. Thank you all for joining us today for what will be a really informative discussion on peripheral vasopressors. And today, as our guest, we're very fortunate to have Dr. Elizabeth Munro, the first author of the CHEST publication entitled Use and Outcomes of Peripheral Vasopressors in Early Sepsis-Induced Hypotension. So Dr. Munro, could you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. So my name is Elizabeth Munro. I'm a research fellow and clinical instructor in pulmonary and critical care medicine at the University of Michigan. And I study sepsis, and particularly I'm interested in how we manage early sepsis and sepsis resuscitation.
An absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. So maybe we can kick off this discussion on why do we use vasopressors in sepsis-induced hypotension? And why have we previously not really used peripheral vasopressors as our main form of delivery?
Yeah, that's a great question. So sepsis continues to be a major problem and a major source of mortality for us. It's a common diagnosis that we manage in the ICU. And of course, when someone's hypotensive from sepsis, we really have two key tools in our toolbox. We can use fluids and we can use vasopressors. And it used to be, I don't know if it was completely straightforward, but it used to be that you would give fluids, and when the patient was continuing to be hypotensive despite fluids, then you would add on vasopressors, traditionally through a central line. But I think there's been a couple of shifts over the past few years. Particularly, we've seen that there's increasing concern about fluid overload in sepsis, that giving too much fluid may increase mortality. And so there's been the shift that we've seen in practice, but also in studies like CLOVERS and CLASSICS, where there's been a growing interest in giving earlier vasopressors. And it's really hard to give earlier vasopressors when you need to give them through a central line, because central lines take time to place. And so this has kind of come alongside with emerging evidence that peripheral vasopressors may be safe to use. And so kind of coming together, there's been a shift in practice towards restricting fluids. So giving some fluids up front, but then starting vasopressors faster. And really, peripheral vasopressors are what allow that to happen. And the reason that we didn't used to use peripheral vasopressors really stems from case studies that actually date back to the 50s and 60s, where there was an extravasation with peripheral vasopressors that resulted in really catastrophic tissue injury. Then that led to the concern that we shouldn't be giving vasopressors peripherally. But one of the things about those studies is that they were using vasopressors. They didn't even have pumps at that time, so they were kind of dripping in vasopressors. They were using them in different veins, like many of the cases are in the legs. So there were a lot fewer restrictions and focus on its use, but it was really out of those catastrophic tissue injuries and amputations from peripheral vasopressor extravasation that led to this concept that vasopressors need to be given centrally, which we're now kind of seeing challenged over the past few years.
Yeah, that's one of the curious things about critical care. A lot of the practices that we have are essentially dogma, and it's based on what your attending told you, and it's based on what his or her attending told them. And we do a lot of stuff, and we don't have a lot of good evidence for what we do. So it's very important to go and challenge those practices. For our audience, what vasopressors are there, and do any of them have any increased likelihood of causing either local tissue injury or the digital gangrene or distal tips? The presses that we tend to use are norepinephrine, phenylephrine, vasopressin, epinephrine. Do any of them have a proclivity to cause that kind of injury?
Yeah, that's a great question, because there's a common conception that norepinephrine is somehow more dangerous, even though that's our first line vasopressor. And I think that stems out of the fact that those early case reports I was talking about were actually with norepinephrine, because it was the primary vasopressor at the time. But epinephrine has now been the most studied peripherally and appears to be very safe. The other catecholamines, phenylephrine, dopamine, and epinephrine have been studied in small numbers in these safety studies. So appear to be safe, but again, small numbers of use. I think the ones you really need to be careful about are the ones that don't act through the mechanism of action of catecholamines, particularly vasopressin. That really has not been studied, and that could potentially be a problem. We don't know, but because it hasn't been studied. But one of the things that's different about that is if you have a catecholamine extravasate, you can address it by giving local phentolamine to counteract the effects. So it kind of has an antidote in a way, whereas vasopressin acts differently, and something like angiotensin II might also act differently. So we don't really know what happens if those extravasate. So traditionally, peripheral vasopressors are being limited to the catecholamines, with norepinephrine being safe, although there's this kind of conception that it shouldn't be used, which I think should be challenged.
So there are a lot of people who are using peripheral vasopressors, and you decided to go ahead and study this. Why did you perform the study, and what were your study aims?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, there's been more and more use of peripheral vasopressors, at least what we had seen anecdotally, as well as for me personally. So I came from a training program where we weren't allowed to use peripheral vasopressors. And so I was used to giving a lot of fluid up front to maintain the blood pressure while I was waiting to put in a central line or getting consent, putting one in. And I found myself using a lot of fluids. And then I came to fellowship at a different institution at Michigan, and we were allowed to use peripheral vasopressors with protocols and safety checks. And I found that because I was able to start vasopressors sooner, it really changed my practice of how much fluid I gave, how fast I started vasopressors, which made me interested in understanding what are the practices and how does this kind of practical consideration of how do you give a vasopressor, which seems just kind of, you know, routine, and but how does challenging that dogma that it needs to be given centrally affect other practices and actually potentially even patient outcomes? And so that's why we did the study, was really to look at three different things. First of all, what actual practice patterns are happening with peripheral vasopressor use? Are they being used broadly? I mean, I had come from two different institutions that had two completely different approaches to this. And then also, is there what factors are being associated with peripheral vasopressor initiation? Are there certain patients that we're using these in more commonly? And then finally, is there any association between using peripheral vasopressors and patient outcomes? Particularly, we looked at mortality.
Great. So let's jump into your study method. How did you design your study? It was a retrospective study, but what details can you provide our listeners so that they could have a full context of what happened? And how did your study design address any limitations of former studies on this topic?
Yeah, so we did a retrospective cohort study using data from a multi-center quality collaborative initiative called the Michigan Hospital Medicine Safety Consortium, or HMS for short, which is a quality initiative sponsored by the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. And this HMS basically has sponsored a sepsis registry, which is a wonderful resource to help us both improve sepsis care across Michigan, but also to understand broader practice patterns. So essentially, each hospital in our network has a trained nurse abstractor on site who takes data from the EHR and populates it into our forms. So we have really high quality data about tons of different things within sepsis, but particularly for the case here about fluids and vasopressor use in the first few days. And so that was really the kind of the context that we were studying this in, which is different than prior studies. So there's been many really excellent studies of peripheral vasopressor safety. Those have been kind of smaller to, 500 to 600 patients, where they've implemented peripheral vasopressor protocols and then looked at the safety. And so they were able to get really detailed looks at use and safety, but they were single-centered. And then the other problem with them is that the protocols have also varied. And so what we saw in an earlier study that we did through HMS is that different hospitals had different policies regarding peripheral vasopressor use. Some said you can't use it at all. Some said you can use it, but with these limitations. And so with all of that kind of variation out there, we really were able to use this multi-center data set to better understand a broader swath of practice patterns across multiple different hospitals.
Great. And then can you comment on what your definition of peripheral was? Because there's obviously a PICC line, and I would assume that you would consider a PICC line a central line. But there's also midlines, and then there's other types of venous catheters, 18-gauge, 20-gauge, 23-gauge. Did you limit the peripheral vasopressors to any of these? What did you consider a midline? Was a 23-gauge too small? Did it have to be a 16-gauge or 18-gauge?
Yeah, those are all great questions. So We consider peripheral vasopressors to be anything given through specifically a peripheral IV. We didn't have any size limitations on that because, unfortunately, that data isn't abstracted into our data set. Because it's a quality initiative, we kind of have to be really pragmatic about what data we're collecting. And so we collected very detailed information about when vasopressors were started and what route they were administered by, and then when central lines were placed subsequent to that. But we didn't have any information about those peripheral IVs that the vasopressors were running through. So we didn't have particular sizes. We didn't include midlines. There were only, first of all, only two midlines in the study population, two out of the about 600 patients. But we didn't include them because our thought was that midlines, while they are peripheral, they may be a bit more secure than a peripheral IV. And so they're kind of a middle category, and we didn't want that kind of obscuring the analysis. So we had planned to exclude midlines up front and then found that they were only a small number of them. And then central lines we defined pretty broadly to include anything that goes into the central vein. So that was temporary CVCs, tunneled catheters, ports, peripherally inserted central catheters, because they do go into the central venous vasculature, so should not have the same risk of extravasation and tissue injury if there was as a peripheral IV would. We also excluded intraosseous or IO lines, essentially, because similar to midlines, they're kind of this middle category where they're technically going into the central vasculature, but they're also only last 24 hours. They're a little bit more unstable. So we wanted to kind of really get a better, clearer picture of using a peripheral IV versus a more secure central access as the primary comparison.
That's pretty useful. And then I would assume that based on the fact that you don't have enough time to put in a central line and that you don't have enough time to put in an A line, so you're basically monitoring these patients with a cuff pressure. Would that be correct? And what do you think limitations that would introduce?
Yeah, so we didn't collect information about whether arterial lines were placed in these patients. I think it's a really interesting question and important for future studies, especially as we're moving to kind of less invasive approaches, peripheral vasopressors. Do we also still need that invasive arterial line? So I don't have an answer for you about how many of these patients were on arterial lines. What I can say is that this was all with included because we have the best data for the first 6 hours of our cohort. We were really looking at patients who came to the ER and were initiated on vasopressors within those first 6 hours. So I imagine, based on kind of common practice, that if the arterial lines were getting placed, they probably weren't there initially and were getting placed during that time. So it's kind of that initial management process.
Great. I think we've got a pretty good idea of what your study was about. So let's jump into your key findings. What did you find and how did you interpret them?
Yes, so we found a couple of different interesting things. So the first thing is that we found that peripheral vasopressor initiation, meaning starting a vasopressor through a peripheral IV, was really common. So of the 594 patients in our study who had vasopressor started within 6 hours of their initial sepsis and arrival, two-thirds of those patients, 67%, had that vasopressor started through a peripheral IV. And then 154, about a quarter, had it started through a central line. And then the remainder had either midlines, IOs, which we had excluded, or other or unknown routes. And so it was interesting that kind of a majority of patients in this cohort had these vasopressors started through peripheral IVs. But they weren't really continued. So the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines in 2021 said, it's okay to start vasopressors peripherally, but recommend start placing a central line kind of as soon as feasible. And we did see that seems to be the most common practice. So of the patients who have started on peripheral vasopressors, about half of them, a little over half, have a central line placed pretty quickly, within 6 hours to 12 hours. So that seems to be the most common practice. Although we did see that about a third of patients who were started on vasopressors peripherally actually never required a central line. They were able to mostly came off of vasopressors. And then we also saw that peripheral vasopressor initiation was faster, only about 30 minutes faster on average, but still kind of fitting with this picture of being able to use peripheral vasopressors, allowing you to really expedite your vasopressor initiation. So that kind of showed us that this practice is really common across these hospitals, and that it does have these advantages that have been hypothesized, that you can start vasopressors faster, and in some patients, you may even be able to avoid that central line. And importantly, we didn't find any association between the peripheral vasopressor initiation, so starting that vasopressor through a peripheral IV, and any patient outcomes. We particularly looked at mortality and dialysis and intubation, and there were no differences. And then we also, while we were limited in what we could collect about complications just due to the data set, we did have any documented peripheral vasopressor complications, and there were none. So that really kind of builds on this growing evidence that using peripheral vasopressors is, at least initiating vasopressors peripherally, is safe and not associated with any harms. The other thing that we found, though, that is a little bit of concern and suggests that we need a little bit more standardization is two things. The first, like we kind of talked about earlier, is that we saw less norepinephrine being used peripherally. So only 84% of patients with peripheral vasopressors had norepinephrine as their first vasopressor versus over 96% in the patients who had vasopressors started centrally, which probably still reflects this residual concern we were talking about the safety of peripheral vasopressors. And that's a particular problem because the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines recommend norepinephrine as a first-line vasopressor. And it's one of the few actually strong recommendations. So the fact that we're seeing people kind of using peripheral vasopressors but hesitant to use norepinephrine may suggest that we need to provide a little bit more guidance in that area. And then the
What vasopressor did they use instead? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, they used more phenylephrine, epinephrine, and dopamine. So just kind of other things.
Yeah, which would be interesting because, the dopamine is available in the crash cart, so it's easy to reach versus the other ones. My understanding is that it takes a bit more time for them to prepare the norepinephrine, so it may have just been a stopgap measure.
Yeah, it definitely could have been a stopgap. And then we did push doses were included. So you obviously can push dose phenyl, and if you're in a really tough situation, epi. But I don't think it's entirely explained by that, just because we excluded anyone who had vasopressors being used just for a procedure or started during CPR. So we tried to kind of take out those patients who might be most likely to be getting those push doses. So certainly availability of crash doses of medication may play some role in that. I do think there's probably a component of concern about the safety, particularly also because there's been some surveys, a large kind of multicenter survey of pharmacists in critical care that show that there was many of them had this kind of reservation about peripheral norepinephrine. So it's probably a combination of all those things. And I think worth kind of saying that the peripheral norepinephrine is safe and can be used if you have it available.
Gotcha. And then what other findings did you have? And then can you comment on fluid volume? Because that's one of the points that you mentioned early in the podcast, that you could theoretically decrease the volume of fluid that we administered to patients. Did you see any difference in fluids? And what else did you find?
Yeah, so we didn't see any difference in fluids. They were, I forget the exact numbers, but there were similar volumes of fluid in each arm. So that theory didn't pan out. although who knows, this was all kind of initial vasopressors. So potentially we looked at fluids in the first 6 hours. So maybe it did affect fluids down the line, but there was no difference in fluids given. And then the other thing that I was going to mention is just that we were expecting that the patients who got peripheral vasopressors would actually look different than the patients who got central vasopressors. Our hypothesis was that they were going to be sicker patients, but that actually wasn't the case. So when we compared patient characteristics between patients who got peripheral versus central initiation, they were very similar. And when we ran a multi-level model to look at factors that predicted whether or not a patient would be started on vasopressors peripherally, there was a statistically significant effect of BMI, but that was the confidence interval barely crossed one. So it was a teeny tiny effect. And in contrast, which hospital you were at was actually much more predictive of whether you would get vasopressors started peripherally. Again, kind of speaking to this, this kind of fact that this is an evolving area. So is being done differently at different hospitals, with the range from 25% peripheral at one hospital all the way up to 95% peripheral at a different hospital. So kind of a wide range, and hospital seems to be much more important for peripheral initiation than actual patient characteristics.
Sure. And then how do you interpret these findings? So you found that peripheral vasopressor use was common initially. It appears to be safe, but this is a retrospective study. So how would you interpret your findings and make it relevant for the broader critical care community?
Yeah, so I think this finding says that this is happening in practice. So, you know, anecdotally, we've heard about these shifts. Studies like Clover's allowed peripheral vasopressors. There seems to be this overall shift in the community towards accepting this practice. Our study doesn't provide very much information about safety. As I said, our ability to capture safety was really just anything documented. So we didn't capture extravasations or any minor complications. So I think the other studies that have happened that have looked at specific protocols and implementation are much better to understand that this is safe. But I think that our study shows that it's actually happening. So it's safe and it's happening in practice. But how much it's happening is really dependent on the institution. And the other interesting thing about that is we actually were able to match the policies on vasopressors that we had from an earlier study to the hospitals and their practice. And we expected that hospitals that had policies that allowed peripheral vasopressors would use more peripheral vasopressors. And those that said no, really, central lines are recommended or required would not have much peripheral vasopressor use. But that wasn't the case. The policy did not actually correlate at all with what was happening in practice. I think my major takeaway from this is that we know that people are using peripheral vasopressors. It's happening regardless of a hospital policy. And we also know from the other safety studies that we can expect some extravasation with peripheral vasopressors on the range of 3 to 5%. And so what helps prevent that extravasation from becoming tissue injury and damage and amputations is catching it early and responding to it. And so the fact that our policies and our practice aren't really matching each other, I think, provides us with an opportunity to kind of reexamine what is happening, which is broad use of peripheral vasopressors, and then kind of adapt our policies and update our policies to reflect that that's happening, so that when we're using peripheral vasopressors, we have someone monitoring them, we have safety checks in place, because we know that they're already being used.
That's a really good summation. So I want to walk this down a little bit further, because there's some who would look at your study and say, oh my gosh, peripheral vasopressors, they were used frequently, no real safety issues that were detected in this study. Why don't we just switch everyone to peripheral vasopressors? And I'm curious to hear your answer on that, because in the last 10 or 15 years, there's definitely been a push for less is more in the ICU, and it's had some detrimental effects. I mean, we've heard folks say, oh, we don't need ABGs anymore, we'll just do pulse oximetry. And there was a study that came out recently that showed that there's a lot of bias with pulse oximetry. There are folks who said, we don't need A-lines anymore, just use the cuff pressure. And we found that it's not an accurate measurement. And we in the critical care community have a habit of taking retrospective studies, which haven't been validated in prospective studies or randomized clinical trials, and taking it all the way down the line and advocating for treatments that aren't indicated. And the most recent one of that was vitamin C, where everyone jumped on board that bandwagon and it didn't pan out. So how could you explain to our audience, like, how far does your study go and what additional studies are needed before folks are can confidently say that peripheral vasopressors can be used routinely?
Yeah, absolutely. There are certainly many limitations to this study. And I think one of the key ones that you're kind of highlighting is what we particularly looked at was initiation. So that's just literally, how did you start the vasopressor? I think the key to kind of that will help us figure out what we should be doing in practice is then what do you do next? So that kind of continuation piece, which we looked at a little bit, but we had fewer numbers, so not a lot, couldn't draw very many conclusions. But there's, I think, pretty safe to say that just starting, as long as you have an IV that's working, starting a peripheral vasopressor while you're managing other things is a reasonable approach. But then the question is, do you put in that central line quickly, like most of our, over half of our providers did in this study, and as is recommended by surviving sepsis? So you kind of use it as a bridge to get you time, buy you time to place that central line? Or are you able to actually even continue the peripheral vasopressors longer? And I think that's where we don't have a lot of evidence and need more information. We saw that patients who were continued on peripheral vasopressors for longer and avoided central lines, that third of patients, they had they were less sick. So they had less heart failure, renal failure, lower lactates, and they were only on vasopressors for 1 to 2 days and only single vasopressors. So there seems to be something happening in practice where people are continuing vasopressors after initiation, kind of avoiding the central line and putting it off and putting it off. And then in some patients, if they're not sick, not ever needing it. And that's the piece that I think we need to kind of understand, because a lot of the, our study doesn't provide a ton of information about the safety of that approach, particularly because it's retrospective, we're missing detailed safety information. But the studies that have implemented protocols with certain, for example, the study that's coming out in CHEST by Dr. Yerke and his group implemented a peripheral vasopressor protocol and then allowed peripheral administration for up beyond even 48 hours with certain limitations. And I think that's where we don't know what is safe. You know, and we probably need some more prospective studies of a can you continue vasopressors? Is that safe? And if so, for how long? And which of these many different, from all these different safety studies, which of these many different limits are actually important and which are not? I think monitoring and managing extravasations is like, makes sense and has been in all of the studies, but things like which, how much dose can you go up to? How long can you run it peripherally? All of that, I think, is completely up in the air. And there's some conflicting information and different studies have done different approaches. So as we're thinking about how can we incorporate this into practice and can it help us de-escalate some of those central lines we're putting in, that's where we're going to need some more information.
I mean, can you comment on the settings? I mean, you mentioned it, there are different hospital settings here. Are all those hospitals staffed by critical care physicians? Because it is becoming increasingly known that there are some hospitals that just don't have critical care access or folks on site, that they're doing it via tele-ICU, and whether or not there are people in that institution who are proficient in putting in central lines or who can put in PICs. Were you able to examine that in your study?
Yeah, so we didn't actually examine that in this study, but we have information from the HMS cohort. So in general, the hospitals are fairly diverse. So their size ranges from very small, like 30 plus beds to thousands of beds. And they really have a case, different variety of case mix. And also they're all across the state of Michigan. So some of them are urban, some of them are rural. So it is a pretty representative sample of both community and academic centers of varying sizes around the state. When we did survey them separately, not reported in the study, but when we surveyed those hospitals and asked them, you know, how do you have someone who can place a central line 24/7? A vast majority do. So even the smaller community centers have someone who's able to place it. Many fewer had the ability to place PICs that rapidly. Most of them, you know, had Monday through Friday set hours for PICs. But it seemed like even though we do include some of these smaller hospitals, there are mechanisms to place central lines. And then interestingly, we did also in this study look at, did time of day of admission or day of the week impact that peripheral versus central initiation, thinking that maybe off hours you might have fewer resources, and it did not have an effect. So there was similar use of peripheral vasopressors in the day, at night, over the weekend. So it doesn't seem to really be a provider limitation, and it's more seems to be a practice that providers are using potentially because it's faster, other potential benefits.
And then going forward, are you planning a prospective study to examine this? Would you encourage other centers in other states or overseas to examine this question as well?
Yeah, We are not planning one. I think we already have a peripheral vasopressor protocol that is well established. And so attempting to get people kind of walking that back to placing central lines again may be challenging. But I do think that institutions who are starting, and some of our collaborators are doing this, who are starting to design protocols and implement them at their hospital, that it's a really good opportunity to study that prospectively after implementation, particularly keeping in mind those different categories of duration, dosing, those different things, and then tracking outcomes and complications prospectively when you're implementing a new protocol. And I know many people have done that and are working on doing that. And I think that's going to be a great way to kind of gather additional information, because it is a tricky area to actually do a trial in. It might be easier if you're coming from an institution doing all central lines and you're switching over to peripheral. But I thought about that a lot at our institution, but it would be really challenging to make people walk back a peripheral vasopressor use that has generally been safe and put a central line in. So I think it's an important area where we need more information. And as hospitals are evolving and adopting these new protocols, it's a great opportunity to study that prospectively.
Yeah, I think definitely, because we end up having a lot of retrospective studies showing something and everyone gets on board, and then we eventually find out 10 years later that there actually is no prospective data on it. In your protocol, do you all specify the gauge of the peripheral IV? Do you say 18 gauge, 16 gauge? Is there a limit?
Yeah, at our hospital, we do specify the gauge. We model our protocol off of one of the early studies by Cardenas Garcia, who did one of the kind of first prospective evaluations of peripheral vasopressor use. So we use very similar cutoffs. It's required to look up by ultrasound. All these things that we don't know kind of what is the optimal protocol to prevent complications that all need to be continue to be evaluated. But we have pretty strict guidelines, which is another reason why I think it's really important that these to know that this is happening regardless of the protocol, because other hospitals may want to look into, you know, what is happening at their institution, and if peripheral vasopressors are being used, do they need to kind of provide this guidance, because it might not be known, you know, to make sure it's an ultrasound guided or to make sure that it draws back and it's in a certain location, it's a certain size, that all those pieces that are maybe important to the safety, that are embedded in a lot of these protocols are important to keep in mind in hospitals where this is happening without correlating policies.
Yeah, I think that's really important, the fact that you've clarified that they've got to be perfectly inserted with an ultrasound and verified, and must flash back. Otherwise, we end up having a lot of people getting started on peripheral IVs that haven't had those criteria. Elizabeth, you've been very gracious with your time, and this has been a really interesting discussion. For our audience, before we sign off, how can you summarize your study's findings, and how does it advance clinical practice?
Yeah, so I think, like we've been talking about, that this peripheral initiation, so starting a vasopressor peripherally, is something that's happening. And while it needs to be done carefully, appears to be safe and also have advantages of being faster, preventing the need for central lines, so all sorts of reasons to potentially consider starting vasopressors peripherally. But keeping in mind that we don't really know the optimal way to continue that. And so the current kind of recommendations and best practice is to start peripherally and place that central line. And that's really where we need more understanding and research prospectively to understand what is it safe to continue. But another an opportunity to look at how these are being used at your hospital, whether or not you're using vasopressors peripherally in your practice. And if you are starting to, kind of thinking about how to do that safely with using some of these, not from our study, but other well-done studies, looking at what safety qualifications are needed to do this practice and de-escalate safely.
Perfect. Well, a very big thank you to Dr. Monroe for a really interesting conversation, and a big thank you to our CHESS community for joining us. I'm Dominic Pepper, and this is a CHESS podcast.